The Boulder Tech Podcast is presented by Boulder Startup Week 2019 title sponsor, Techstars. At the core, Techstars is a company founded by entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs. With more than 300,000 alumni and 10,000 mentors across 150 countries, Techstars is a worldwide network that helps entrepreneurs succeed. To learn more, go to techstars.com. Welcome to the Boulder Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Joel Davis. Episode 40 of the Boulder Tech Podcast is part of a special Wild series of interviews recorded during the 10th annual Boulder Startup Week. Wild, or Women Inspiring Leadership Development, is a new track at Boulder Startup Week 2019 and features candid conversations celebrating women's startup success, diversity, power, mentoring muscle, and leadership impact. For the Wild series, I'm pleased to hand off interviewing duties to Stephanie Brady, Managing Director at IFG Studios and Board Member of the Wild Council. On today's episode, Stephanie speaks with Megan Bent, founder of Harbinger Ventures. They discuss startup lessons she's learned, Megan's passion for supporting female founders, creating a new shared benefit model of venture funding, and more on this episode of the Boulder Tech Podcast.
Well, thanks, Joel. On this episode of Wild, we are pleased to feature Megan Bent, founder and managing partner at Harbinger Ventures. And prior to founding Harbinger in 2016, Megan served as managing director of Revelry Brands for 9 years. A lifelong investor and entrepreneur with deep expertise in consumer brands, Megan has spent the past decade working to identify and scale high-growth, early-stage companies in the consumer sector, serving as lead director, problem solver, operator, strategic thinker, and yes, confidant to emerging entrepreneurs. Megan Bent, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you a few questions. Just to first start out, what inspired you to start Harbinger Ventures?
You know, like so many entrepreneurs, I started Harbinger because I saw an opportunity in the market. And it just happens to be that my market is financial services. But what I saw was that you have this innovation and evolution of the entrepreneur. And I'm specifically focused on consumer segments. So you also see an innovation and evolution of the consumer. And then you map all the way back to the investor who's providing the capital. And you don't see a lot of changes or innovation or differences in terms of how they invest, why they invest, or how they engage. And I felt there was a real opportunity to track back from the products you're bringing in the market all the way to the source of capital and say, how do we create continuity and alignment? And so put Harbinger into market a couple of years ago, first as a beta, and now we're scaling it up to solve some of those, what I call gaps between the capital providers and the actual investment itself.
What do you think is one of the biggest gaps or opportunities you can jump into that
sector? Absolutely. First and foremost, I think there tends to be an opportunity for the business owners and entrepreneurs to do a better job of actually understanding the business of money. What is it that a private equity partner does? How are they measured? How are they made successful? And how do you as an entrepreneur make sure that your business goals and their business goals really line up? Private equity's done a great job of kind of articulating this black box strategy. There's something kind of seductive to raising private equity. But at the end of the day, you've got two business owners that are merging. One's putting in capital, one's putting in brand or resources or revenue. And the goal is together to create value for everybody. And so as a private equity partner, I take kind of a lot of responsibility in ensuring that I'm incredibly straightforward and transparent about what is it that I'm doing? How am I going to be measured? And how do we make sure we succeed together?
But why did you decide for Harbinger Ventures to focus specifically on funding female founders or female-led startups?
Absolutely. I mean, it comes back to a couple different reasons. You know, one is specifically in consumer where I'm investing, it's good for the business model to have a female perspective guaranteed in the business. You know, you're selling to consumers where 80% of purchase decisions are made by women. There's just a rational component to ensuring that your innovation, your marketing, your leadership has that sort of intuition at the table. So for my sector specifically, it's just good business practices. clients. More broadly, though, the way that I look at it is there's really good research and data about the value of diverse thinking. Diverse thinking at the board level, diverse thinking at the management team level, you get better innovation, you get better risk management, you get better governance. It's really hard to go back in time and retrofit an existing company to be more diverse. It's much easier to do it from day one. And so what I say is we put a stake in the ground about having female leadership and we get about 50-50 balanced teams. If we had no stake in the ground, we'd probably end up where everybody else does, which is predominantly male. So putting that stake in the ground holds us accountable to practicing best business practices.
Tell us a little bit about Harbinger's unique collective leadership, collective learning, and in fact, collective ownership model.
One of the things that I experienced and my business partner experienced having spent quite a bit of time really deep in the entrepreneurial community is as an equity partner, we tend to overvalue what we truly bring to the table. You know, our experience is as a generalist, in many ways, it's almost superficial in nature, but from a pure operating and problem solving and innovating perspective, there's so much value that gets trapped and siloed down in these companies. So the question that I posed to myself was, how do you unlock that? How do you actually engage the different extremely busy operators to collaborate more and collaborate tactically, you know, maybe actually sharing services or opportunities or resources to be more cost efficient or scalable, but maybe just collaborate strategically and unlock those synergies as well. And from my perspective, when you force people to put skin in the game, you get fundamentally different behavior. And so what we did at Harbinger was incentivize community building and collaboration by giving each of our founders an actual piece of the fund. They benefit when another founder generates value and wealth creation. And so there's an economic motivation to be engaged in the community. But the second thing that we did is our portfolio strategy is really designed to create a very cohesive collection of companies. We stay in our lane, so to speak. We make very few investments per fund. We're incredibly concentrated, and all of those investments share very similar properties. So there's almost a cohort or a class that's coming up together where from a life stage perspective, a leadership perspective, a consumer perspective, there's quite a bit of overlap in what they're doing. And so the relevance of the community also really matters. And, you know, the combination of the profile of the companies, the concentration of the fund, and the economic incentive, our hope is that it transforms kind of a network into a true community.
Are you seeing any payout of that 3 years in? Does it take a long time?
Two dotted lines make a line. Yeah, two dots make a line, right? Absolutely. Yeah. So when I started, this idea was at the back of my mind versus in practice. And it was probably about 18 months in that we put it in practice. And I qualitatively can say there was a step change in engagement from the founders, a step change in engagement from the teams. Their willingness to information share, to learn from each other, collaborate, really took on a totally different tone and profile. From a quantifiable perspective, who knows? You know, we're a three-year-old fund. What I can say is that our portfolio is dynamic. The growth is exciting. The entrepreneurs as leaders are really developing at a rate that exceeds what you'd expect from going from a founder into a CEO or a business leader. And so would I credit our community building efforts against all of that? Absolutely not. We're a small piece of the puzzle, but we're encouraged.
You've been incubating new ventures and managing startup investments almost your entire career, first at Reverly, then at Harbinger Ventures. But what traits do you see most often in successful entrepreneurs?
I have a real reverence for entrepreneurs. I truly believe they're kind of a force of nature and they think differently. And what I spend a lot of time trying to figure out when I'm selecting an investment is this a real entrepreneur or is this someone who's entrepreneurial? Because they're two different things. And, you know, to really succeed, you need to be an entrepreneur. And for me, it boils down to three core traits. The first is a vision, you know, kind of a transformational vision, something that they're passionate about. They really see the world differently. And we can walk through some examples later, but, you know, just fundamentally a vision capability that's beyond your average executor. The second thing, though, is an ability to bring that vision to life. So really good execution. And my primary source of measurement as I get to know entrepreneurs over many years is, can you do what you say you're going to do? If your goal is to grow or expand gross margins or find new customers, are you able to do that really consistently at a rate and cost effectiveness and accuracy that you said? That's good execution. And so much of business value is created in kind of the boring stuff, which is one foot after the other, getting it done. And then the last component would be grit. You know, it's really hard. It's really lonely. You have this almost baby in your head all the time. It's something you think about, and the rest of the world just keeps moving by. And so what I look for in those entrepreneurs is just that ability to continue to maintain that passion and vision and execution through all the inevitable ups and downs of building a startup. And when those three things come together, you see just this really powerful force of change moving into a market at an unexpected, unexplainable rate. There's kind of a viral component to what they're doing where you say, it just doesn't make sense that a company that small could be that powerful. And it's because those three factors line up in a really great way.
Can you give us an example?
Oh, sure. One of our first investments out of this second fund at Harbinger is a brand called Cora. And one of the co-founders of Cora is a woman named Molly. And, you know, Molly has a wisdom well beyond her years. She's barely 30 years old, but has this sense of what modern womanhood looks like. This business sells very unsexy products. These are femcare products. Who wants to talk about that? Almost no investors, I'll tell you that. But also, you know, broadly the press, no one. It's just not a topic that's really trendy. But she's had an ability to generate a real discussion through her focus on core topics around womanhood that are really fundamental, really critical, but very taboo. And her sense of really pushing forward the modern woman, pulling in traits from the political world, from the leadership world, from the CEO world, and incorporating it into this like core commodity product has really allowed this company's brand to take on a life of its own. They have a brand persona as an activist. They have a brand persona as a product innovator and visionary. And this is a tiny company that got started just a few years ago. So really pushing the boundaries on what this product can be and what they're willing to talk about and how they're willing to talk about it has allowed it to be bigger than life.
I'm going to turn the tables on you a little bit and talk about your entrepreneurial traits or your entrepreneurialism. What's your secret sauce? What are some of the traits that you feel like you bring uniquely to the table?
I always like to say I'm trilingual in this early stage world. My original mentors were an entrepreneur, an investment banker, and a lawyer. So, you know, three odd ducks, but absolutely critical to what I do, which is work with entrepreneurs, deploy capital, and create alignment. And so for me, really staying true to each of those different core skill sets, keeping those fine motor skills up and translating back and forth between them, I think allows me to sit with many different audiences and generate collaboration and alignment in ways that's maybe unusual in some.
Part of that trajectory, if you think across your career, was most surprising to you or unplanned?
Oh, that is a good question. You know, I consistently find myself in positions, and this started when I joined Revelry and I was 24 at the time, which was, how did I get here and what am I going to do to solve the problems they're asking me to solve? I am not qualified. And that sort of, you know, back of the mind commentary, I think is very common to many entrepreneurs and many women, and specifically, you know, that imposter syndrome. And so I think I surprise myself on a daily basis in terms of being able to accomplish what you want to accomplish and finding that if you imagine it like a business, you know, set a plan, execute against the plan, remain confident and communicate well, transparently with your stakeholders, there's a lot of support that you can garner as you're building something.
So what advice would you give a female founder about, one, investing in themselves, and then second, investing their time, talent, and treasure in their career?
You know, starting with investing in yourself, I think for our founders, for myself, we invest meaningful resources. You know, I can measure this as a percent of our budget into the journey of self-awareness. Being a woman, being a leader requires you to really understand what motivates you, what are you afraid of, what are your roadblocks, and what's your strategy to overcome them? You know, how do you ensure that you're building stakeholders around you that support your weaknesses and cheer you on your strengths? And that sort of journey doesn't happen accidentally. So as an example, personally, I've invested over the course of my career with my own dollar into really great executive coaching opportunities. I've invested significant time into building mentors that I really trust, where the goal is to have those mentors challenge me and push me and hold me accountable to things. And we try to play that same role back to the founder. So, you know, what I would say to women as they're building themselves up personally is invest in that journey, invest the time, invest the resources or the dollar, take risks around it, and then hold yourself accountable to it. It's very difficult for it to happen if you're not paying attention.
What's next for Harbinger? Where do you see that trajectory? It's already 3 years in. What would the next 3 to 5 years bring you?
Yeah, this is a question we get asked a lot right now, so it's very timely. Personally, I consider ourselves still very much in the infancy of our firm building. Like many entrepreneurs that are listening to this, we're still scrappy. We're still under-resourced relative to what we think we can build. We have a much larger vision for the type of firm and culture we'd like to build. So for me, the next 12 months are about proving that we have the credibility and the proof of concept to go do that. So it's earning permission. And so for me, this is a very execution-heavy phase. In collaboration with that, we're telling our story. So we're getting smarter and more articulate in terms of how we share what we do with the investment community and the entrepreneur community. 24 months from now, we'd like to scale that, take the best components of our strategy that are working well, continue to fund those, and maybe discontinue parts of the strategy that could have been done better. It'll involve building an organization. It'll involve raising more capital, but it'll always involve staying really core to those values and vision that has differentiated us from day one.
When you think about entrepreneurs looking for funding, what do you see too much of? And what do you see not enough of in their quest search for funding and underwriting of their new ventures?
Sure. So I'll start with an example. 99% of the time when I get on the phone with a new company, they dive straight into their pitch. And they dive into the pitch before they've ever understood, what am I doing on the phone? Why did I take the call? What kind of check can I write? What companies do I look for? And so the next 60 minutes may be a mutual waste of time. They may have missed an opportunity to learn something from me. They may have missed an opportunity to turn the call around in a way that better benefits them. And so the first thing I like to say to entrepreneurs is really use your time wisely. Try to turn the balance of power here. Just because we have capital doesn't mean that we're the only ones with leverage. You bring something really meaningful to the table, which is a really interesting business. It may or may not be relevant to me, but it's relevant to someone. And as capital partners, we see a lot, we learn a lot, and we have lots of kind of broad-based perspective. So if you use the first 15 minutes of the call, for example, to learn about the firm before you pitch, you may decide this isn't worth pitching. I'm going to ask questions. I'm going to ask them, who do you know? How would you do this differently? What's your perspective on this? And you have the chance to transform 60 minutes into a real learning opportunity. So that's an example of really pivoting the balance of powers to better serve your business needs by not allowing private equity to be overly kind of seductive or powerful. We're just people. We're just investing money. And there's things that we can be helpful with and there's things we can't. So for me, that evolution of the balance of power, I think, is something that's really powerful, particularly for women.
So you don't mind when they actually ask in that first few minutes, tell us a little bit about what you're looking for. Mm. What's a good investment? And would that be seen or perceived as being positive or respectful?
So I can speak for myself, and absolutely, I would say it would be perceived as being thoughtful, strategic, curious, business savvy in terms of understanding that you've got goals and I've got goals and I'm trying to make sure how they line up. So for me, I think that would be very positive. I think it also has the ability to change the dynamic of the discussion. You know, it gives the chance for both parties to be very transparent up front in terms of what's the real purpose for this call. Is it a pitch or is it a get to know you call or is it a fact-finding mission where we're going to explore really interesting topics? So in some ways, I've had founders say this where they're like, you know, it's kind of a relief that I know you're not an investor because now I can just open the kimono, share what I'm really thinking, and ask some good questions. And so from my perspective as an investor, that's a great outcome too, because you have the chance to really get to know the people, not just hear the pitch.
One of the cornerstones of Wild is really transforming women to their most powerful sense of leadership. So in a general question, what does leadership mean to you? And what does it look like every day for Megan?
I think it's a very personal question in terms of, you know, what are you good at and what are your values? And for me personally, this is how I live so much of my life. It's doing a few things extremely well. So at Harbinger, we talk a lot about quality, ensuring that every interaction we have with entrepreneurs is value add, it's thoughtful, it's, you know, empathetic, and it's in the furthering of our kind of broader belief that the ecosystem has the ability to be collaborative and regenerative. So, you know, as an example, for me, when I'm building mentorship relationships or leadership relationships with entrepreneur, I'm constantly trying to practice and preach focus. You know, what are the handful of things that you really want to be successful at and concentrate your energy into that? And I think about that a lot in my own life, and it involves saying no to a lot. And so, you know, one of my personal journeys probably over the last decade or so has been, how do you gracefully and confidently say, thank you so much for the opportunity. That doesn't fit with my own priorities. Let me see how I can help you. And that's been empowering for me and something that I pass along to other people as well.
The power of yes and also the power of no.
Absolutely.
True, true. What would you say to other female entrepreneurs or to the marketplace in general when consistently we know the balance of new funds, capital venture funds, to women ventures are quite low? Where is that balance of power? Where can it shift? What will it take to accelerate that to a more equitable level, do you think?
Wow, what a complicated question. And I think there's a thousand directions we can go with it. But, you know, it gets bucketed, I think, into a couple core areas. You know, one is around actually the access to capital and the control of capital and the evolution that has to happen there. And there's really good research around, as women control more capital from the investor perspective, as they control more capital from the fund perspective, as they're decision makers in the investment committee, there's a natural shift that happens. And there's kind of an elimination of bias that very organically occurs, but that takes a long time because you're talking about shifting institutions. But that's happening. If you look at the emergence of micro funds over the last couple of years, there's been so many that have popped up with female GPs in place, may or may not have a gender lens, may or may not have a bias towards kind of female products or solutions or innovations, but that sort of leadership is happening at the grassroots level. From an operational perspective, what I like to say to entrepreneurs and kind of the practice that I preach to myself is, know what the biases are that you're facing. Don't get mad about them, but create a strategy to face them head on. As an example, women tend to be perceived as less data-driven. So show up and know your numbers. You'll be able to reverse that bias into a moment of awe. Wow, that woman really knew her numbers. And that sense of surprise can actually allow what should have been a roadblock to turn into a benefit to you. So that's one example of just really knowing kind of what kind of room are you walking into and what is your very specific strategy to face it head on. And those moments really help. And that may include, you know, bringing advocates into the group. It may include reframing the conversation to not only identify risks, but opportunities. It may involve women leaning more aggressively than they're comfortable into their projections and really allowing themselves to take on that sort of risk or role that you more commonly see with a male entrepreneur. But it really goes back to kind of having a strategy and just knowing it's going to be part of raising capital in this business. And then the last has to do with building your own network. I like to say that sort of network and experience bias that can be a roadblock for them can be a strength. For me personally, relative to my male co-founder at this fund, my network is 80% women. So I have access to different stakeholders and investors and value creators than he does. And so as a female entrepreneur, you have a benefit that you can bring to the table. And I see this a lot, you know, when other private equity firms look to place a female board member. And they say, this is really hard to source and find. Not for us, right? As women, we've got that network. And so really kind of building your own value creating network very proactively, I think can turn a roadblock into an attractive asset.
Do you ever feel like if you look back on your career, was there any piece of advice that either now you would give yourself or somebody else gave you that you wish you had known when you first started?
Yeah. Oh, it's probably so many different pieces. You know, I think one of the ones that comes to mind a lot is, and this is going to sound a bit disassociated, but it's true, which is, you know, in order to make really practical business decisions, you have to care, but not too much. And so you have to find that intersection of passion and vision and excitement, and then pragmatism and an understanding that, you know, at the end of the day, it's not personal. If someone puts money into my fund or I put money into a business, it's not a personal decision. It's a very rational one. And so, you know, being able to kind of transparently align with someone, be pragmatic in that business partnership, has allowed me to actually build really robust friendships and partnerships with people that aren't as disassociated as that statement sounds. But that initial separation of church and state allows for a really healthy upfront foundation building.
Balance. Well said. Megan, I have one last question just to bring this full circle. Share with us your experience of making your own step change. You certainly were with Revelry for 9 years, then started Harbinger. Tell us about that journey. How did that unfold for you?
So I was so fortunate to be at Revelry for so long. And like I said earlier, the mentorship that I had on the entrepreneurial side, what it was like to be an entrepreneur, what it was like to author something, I had full exposure and transparency into. And I don't think my business partner, Brendan at Revelry, or I was surprised the day the contagion caught. And I went back to him and said, I have an idea and I want to launch it and I want to try building something on my own. And I have this desire to be held accountable to the decisions that I make in full and take that risk. And so it took us about 3 years to map out an exit strategy that worked for me and for him. It involved piloting and launching Harbinger almost in an incubated state for about 18 months while I was still running Revelry full time, and then slowly transitioning myself out of Revelry and into Harbinger full time. I'm extremely loyal at heart. And so what was critical to me is that the same kind of gift of mentorship that Brennan had given me, always being supportive against my vision, I wanted to leave him in a great space. And so transition's never easy. It's never perfect or smooth, but we did a really good job in collaboration with each other. And at this point in time, I think I continue to be Revelry and Brendan's biggest fan, supporter, still an investor, and vice versa. He was the first to commit to Harbinger as an investor and has continued to be a real sounding board and mentor to me as we build this new firm.
When you finally made that leap, was there any oh no moment that you truly had to deal with? And how did you overcome that?
Oh, always. When you work for someone else or when you work with somebody else, at the end of the day, you have a little bit of a sense of a safety net. And when you go out on your own, you have these moments of pure feelings of exposure. And so, you know, I felt a lot of responsibility and accountability at Revelry for the decisions that we made, our entrepreneurs, our stakeholders. But Harbinger was probably the first time when you woke up gasping for air in the middle of the night thinking, what did I do? There is nobody else that can be held accountable for the decisions that I've made in investing this money. So it's been a humbling experience, both to raise money behind your own strategy and manage money behind your own decisions, but it's exactly the kinds of risk and responsibility I ultimately wanted. And so I love every minute of it.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
That was Harbinger Ventures founder Megan Bent speaking with the Wild Council's Stephanie Brady as part of the Wild series of interviews recorded during Boulder Startup Week 2019. Learn more at harbingerventures.com. The Wild at Boulder Startup Week podcast series is supported by First Bank, banking for good to help business customers achieve their goals and provide them the resources to succeed. For more information, go to efirstbank.com. The Boulder Tech Podcast is made possible in part by Boulder Startup Week Platinum sponsors Honey, Matter, and Zayo. We're also supported by Glider, a Colorado-based community movement and nonprofit that produces Boulder's Ignite and TEDx events, as well as Boulder Startup Week. Learn more and consider a donation at glider.com. Thanks to Dojo 4 for providing space for our podcast studio, and to KGNU Community Radio for recording gear and studio usage. Our intro music is by Echo Deck. Hear more at echodeck.com. That's ECCODEK. Our outro music is by Earthrise Sound System. You'll find them at earthrisesoundsystem.com. The Boulder Tech Podcast is produced by me, Joel Davis. Your feedback, criticisms, and comments are welcome. Reach me at joel@dojo4.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here for the next episode of the Boulder Tech Podcast.